Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about what we learned from the Democratic and Republican conventions, or better said, what we didn't learn, what to expect in the final 100 days of the presidential campaign. And in a special third part, we're going to talk about the effort to once and for all get rid of nuclear weapons. But before we can move on, and here's some audio from the Republican National Convention, the final words of Donald Trump. Take a listen.
To all Americans tonight, in all of our cities and in all of our towns, I make this promise. We will make America strong again. We will make America proud again. We will make America safe again. And we will make America great again. God bless you and good night. I love you.
And from the Democratic National Convention, here are the final words from Secretary Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Yes, the world is watching what we do. Yes, America's destiny is ours to choose. So let's be stronger together, my fellow Americans. Let's look to the future with courage and confidence. Let's build a better tomorrow for our beloved children and our beloved country. And when we do, America will be greater than ever. Thank you, and may God bless you and the United States of America.
Well, there we have it. The conventions are over, the candidates are officially set, and we are off to the races for the next 100 days. We ultimately, though, did not learn that much from either convention. Both parties are who we thought they were. And in fact, the biggest stories from both conventions really had little to do with the candidates themselves. With the Republicans, it was, well, first the plagiarism of Melania Trump's speech, then ongoing talks about how divided the party was, and then it was the whole issue of Ted Cruz not endorsing Trump and calling for voters to vote their conscience. And admittedly, it's true, on the last day, news did turn to Trump, but he really hadn't said anything that we hadn't already heard from him. We did at least figure out exactly what Trump is going to run on, though. A combination of economic nationalism that is designed to speak to those hurting economically by promising many, many more good-paying jobs, along with a law and order stance that is seeking to capitalize on people's fear of terrorism, racism against Black Lives Matter, and reactionary support for the police. The only interesting wrinkle was when Ivanka Trump, when introducing her father, said that he supported paid family leave and equal pay for women, something Trump had not mentioned at all. Trump had, though, earlier telegraphed a level of support for Planned Parenthood, and it may be possible that he will attempt to undercut Clinton's attacks on him by supporting policies that support the rights of women. Although that seems pretty unlikely to make much of a difference, given the boorish sexist behavior Trump seems to revel in displaying at rallies and in interviews. As for the Democrats, well, again, basically what we expected. On the eve of the convention, WikiLeaks released a trove of emails that detailed very clearly that the Democratic National Committee had indeed colluded with the Hillary Clinton campaign to make it very difficult for Bernie Sanders to win the nomination. It was revealed that they tried to smear Sanders in the media, even going as low as trying to use his religion as a weapon against him. It was also revealed the pay-to-play nature of politics, with the quid pro quo of large amounts of money for various favors and access to the president. While everyone knows that this is the case, it's quite interesting to pull back the curtain and see in real time how meetings with the president and top officials are actually and literally auctioned off. The other very strange thing was that the Democrats, allegedly the party that's the best for the poor and working class, spent most of the time talking about how great America was, how the economy was good, and so on and so forth. Essentially, they had no message for people who feel like they are struggling other than, do not vote for Donald Trump. It seems far more important for them to protect President Obama's legacy than to forge any sort of new path to the election. So it is now totally confirmed Hillary Clinton is not a candidate for change, but the extension of the Obama presidency. The Democrats totally cynically tried to exploit the Black Lives Matter movement several times. And by showing the most basic level of human decency, though, they were able to somehow come off looking slightly better than the RNC. Ultimately, though, I am not sure whether this changed any hearts and minds on either side. Where people were going in is mostly where people were going out. There are always bumps in the polls from conventions, but in this very odd election year, it's unlikely that either convention did much to shake people's very strong feelings about the two candidates. And the final point, and the most important one, a subtext that went almost totally undiscussed. While Trump is postured as someone who is against the quote-unquote establishment, and as several articles have noted, lobbyists and billionaires swarmed the RNC. At the DNC, there were big parties thrown by the ultra-rich, and reporters noted that the message from the one percenters who really control America was, no matter what you hear from the stage, it's still business as usual. And those were today's talking points, and you were listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are joined on the phone to continue this conversation by Miss Jennifer Bryant, who's a journalist and was actually quarterbacking a lot of the coverage of the DNC in Philadelphia for the Pacifica Radio Network. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. And you were there. You were at the DNC in Philly. And, you know, the thing that really struck me watching it from afar was that despite everything going on in the country, the Democrats basically just spent the whole time talking about how America is the greatest country on earth that's ever existed, which usually is what Republicans do. I mean, it just something about it struck me as not right. I mean, did it seem like a discordant note to you what was happening inside and what people are feeling outside?
Yeah, I think it's what we see with the Democratic Party is a symbolism over substance. And we saw that a lot with President Obama's presidency. But when you look at the Democratic National Convention versus the Republican National Convention, I mean, it was incredibly diverse. When Debbie Wasserman Schultz was forced to step down, they put three black women in her place. There were lots of Muslims speaking. There were lots of transgender delegates. So optically, it looked representative of America. But when we dig deeper and we look at the actual content of the speeches, when we look at what issues really weren't represented at all at the convention, you're exactly right. It wasn't reflective of the mood of the country right now.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, too, I know one of the people you guys had on to give some commentary was the daughter of Berta Cáceres, a Central American activist who was assassinated. And, you know, one of the things that one of the big memes, obviously, is feminism. And certainly Hillary Clinton was very supportive of this government that had assassinated Berta Cáceres. And I wonder if you could just share with us a little bit about, you know, what her daughter was saying and feeling and how you think that reflects the way sort of women's issues are being used in the election.
Yeah, I mean, the interview with her daughter talked a lot about internationalism, about the movement in Honduras, about what her mother was fighting for and what her mother meant to the country and to the people there. And I think that listening to her, I mean, Berta Cáceres is a model of what real feminism looks like. And I think when we contrast that with the feminism being presented by Hillary Clinton, there's a really stark difference there. And so that was very clear in that interview. But you have a lot of really prominent women who continue to back Hillary Clinton. But, you know, outside of the arena, there were a lot of really prominent women who were speaking about the difference in Hillary Clinton's feminism and, you know, women's movements across the world and movements led by women. What was interesting to me was the Green Party presidential candidate, Jill Stein, was inside the Wells Fargo Center walking around, and she was just getting so much love.
How did she get in?
Delegates. I don't know.
It was probably Russia. She's a secret agent, and they got her some sort of pass. I'm sorry, but continue. Go ahead.
Yeah, but she was shown so much love by delegates there. I mean, we had her on our Pacifica broadcast, and she did an interview. I saw her on Democracy Now! As well, debating Ben Jealous, which was really interesting. So, yeah, I mean, there were just the Democratic National Convention was a convergence of so many things, and just the level of dissent that was taking place inside the arena, directly outside where Bernie protesters were arrested trying to scale the 8-foot fences that they had set up around the Wells Fargo Center. I was sitting next to some veteran journalists from the BBC who have been going to these conventions for a long time, and they said that they've never seen one that was this kind of tense and that had this much protest in the United States. I mean, even from day one, the opening prayer, the first day of the Democratic National Convention, when Hillary's name was mentioned in the open prayer, there were boos.
Right.
So from the very beginning, it was just a tone of resistance.
Right. Well, and talk a little bit more about that dissent insight. I mean, it was hard to tell. You could get a little bit from social media, but, you know, the CNNs, the MSNBCs, they were basically downplaying it and saying, like, oh, it's just a handful of people who are doing X, Y, Z. I mean, talk about what was the scene there on the floor with folks going at each other?
Yeah, you know, the Bernie delegates seemed to have organized themselves nationally before the convention. I think they were using Slack and other sorts of apps and social media tools to organize themselves. But there were some real themes. California definitely had one of the most radical delegations there. They were kind of leading silent protests and chants basically every day. And so we saw when the former CIA director Panetta was speaking, there were chants of no more war, no more war. There were banner drops inside. Oregon and California were making so much noise and being so disruptive that at one point they just cut the lights over their section.
Wow.
And people were holding up their cell phones to, you know, kind of draw attention. And the Pacifica broadcast was on Radio Row, which was on the 100 level. And there were a few times when we were broadcasting live and delegates would just come out into the hallway chanting and holding up signs. And so, you know, this is my first convention, so I didn't have anything to compare it to, but it was just a lot of dissent.
Yeah, well, I mean, and it seems that, like, towards the end there, the Clinton people started to get themselves together. I saw the journalist Matt Iglesias put out something, actually, that was like what counter chants you should do when you heard the Bernie people do a chant. And the no more war, the counter was USA, USA. And it just struck me as quite interesting in a party of people, all of whom were opposed, just about all of whom were opposed to the Iraq War, the rank and file people. Obviously, Hillary Clinton supported it, who significantly, you know, 60-70% of people have strong anti-war views in the Democratic Party, that all of a sudden it's like this nationalistic orgy of USA chants anytime someone raises an issue of war and peace. I don't know how that seemed inside for you.
Well, you know, one of the main images that was going viral from the Republican National Convention was when Code Pink activists held up a banner that said stop racism or something to that effect, and delegates around them blocked it with an American flag. People were saying, you know, this is really emblematic of the Republican Party. They're super racist. But when there was a banner drop inside the arena that said free the whistleblowers, it was blocked by delegates were blocking it with Hillary posters.
Mm.
And I just thought that was really emblematic of how similar both of these parties are in many ways. And I think for a convention that was really centered on how folks need to unite to defeat Trump and that Hillary is so different from Trump, there were a lot of threads of similarity between the Republican National Convention and the Democratic National Convention. And the way that they addressed protests was one of them.
Let me ask you this. How did the mothers of the movement thing strike you? I mean, it was very interesting to me that they had the mothers of the movement one day, and then in the very next day, in the exact same spot, they had Michael Bloomberg that was the dude over Stop and Frisk. I mean, it was unbelievable to me. Don't know how it struck you.
Well, the mothers of the movement thing, I think, was significant because that was really the only kind of mention that we had of Black Lives Matter. And I don't think Black Lives Matter was mentioned on the stage once. I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't remember hearing it at all. And so that was kind of the only hint that there was a whole movement to stop police terrorism happening outside of the Wells Fargo Arena. To me, it felt like an attempt to exploit these women who have lost their children in a system that still hasn't given them justice, where some of these officers who killed their sons and daughters are still on the forces, the police forces.
And the mayors and the district attorneys who protect them a lot of times are in there as superdelegates.
Yeah, so that really rubbed me the wrong way.
No, I hear you. And you know, it's interesting, too, because you're right. It wasn't really mentioned on the stage at all, Black Lives Matter, that is. And in fact, it was almost like that was a protest, the Wyoming delegation all donning the Black Lives Matter shirts when they, you know, introduced them, the roll call vote or whatever it may be, people chanting it when the mothers of the movement came. But Hillary Clinton, who'd made this huge deal out of it, I don't know. So, I mean, it seems like maybe the takeaway is that Hillary Clinton's whole posturing to the progressive side of things was fake, and now she's going the Rockefeller Republican route, and if you don't agree with that, it's too bad, too sad. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, just the...
And you have 30 seconds.
You mentioned Republicans. What was significant to me, I mean, we have Michael Bloomberg speaking at the Democratic National Convention. There were Republican Women for Hillary, a group spoke at the National Convention. Tim Kaine, who's a fairly conservative governor from Virginia. I think that conservative, you know, that there was a whole thread of conservatives who spoke. And I think it shows how the Republican Party has gone far right, but Hillary Clinton is also trying to push the Democratic Party to the right. And that was tempered a little bit by Bernie Sanders and some of the progressive things that they were able to get on the platform. But I thought that whole theme was really interesting of the conservatives that were speaking at the Democratic National Convention.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll leave it there for now and hopefully for the next 4 years. Thank you to Jennifer Bryant, who was there, a journalist covering the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia for National Pacifica Radio. You are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. We're going to take a break. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about the takeaways from the RNC and the DNC and the next 100 days of the presidential campaign. And we are very excited to be joined in studio by the host of Unanimous Dissent here on Radio Sputnik and the co-founders of District Sentinel. Check it out at districtsentinel.com, Sam Knight and Sam Sachs. I appreciate you guys making the trip out here and being in studio.
Good to be here.
Thanks, Eugene.
Perfect. So I want to just start with maybe the general takeaways here. I mean, it seemed weird to me how the contrasting messages, I mean, it seemed like it was almost a flip from normally. Like usually it's the Republicans who are like, yeah, America is great. And it's the Democrats who are like, yeah, people are struggling. We got to help them. But now it was the reverse opposite. I wonder what you guys make of that. Sam, I'll start with you.
I'll take it.
Go ahead.
Well, look, I think you saw on display at the DNC, at least initially, a nod to its left flank. You saw Bernie Sanders come out and Elizabeth Warren come out on Monday night, the first night of the convention. And then things quickly shifted for the rest of the convention. And the Democratic Party put forward what the posture they're going to take heading into the general election, which is a centrist neoliberal party that rather than trying to appeal to Bernie Sanders supporters or to the left, they're going to try and build a coalition among moderate Democrats and moderate Republicans and think that that's going to be enough to beat Donald Trump.
I thought it was particularly frustrating to see, on one hand, President Obama say, you know, oh, the sort of the Bernie's revolution doesn't stop here. You know, it's continuing. You got to elect Democrats and then hold them accountable. And I thought that phrase was actually quite nice to hear from the president, elect Democrats and hold them accountable, not just elect Democrats and, you know, that's it. Screw you. We got our check, you know.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite parts of the convention,
but
to be honest.
But I wanted to say as well on that, why it was so frustrating is because while you had President Obama on one hand encouraging, you know, sort of internal dissent, for lack of a better term, or internal deliberation, whatever, they're setting the bar so far to the right. You know, I don't know. I mean, I didn't expect Hillary to come out with a rah-rah pro-Bernie message. But by the same token, I mean, maybe it was because I was being dumb and should have expected this. But I don't know the sharp, sharp whip back to the right, you know, cranking out Bloomberg, Panetta, all of them. It was pretty depressing.
And conversely, if you look at what the Republicans put forward in Cleveland 2 weeks ago, they're at least making an appeal. And this is, you know, Thomas Frank, author, you know, pretty good leftist. He brought up a lot of these points, and that is the Republican Party is making a play for the working class, for people who've been left behind by the political establishment here in Washington, D.C., the political establishment that has embraced free trade, that has embraced never-ending war around the world, that has embraced economic policies that keep economic inequality at such high levels. And obviously, Trump and Republicans aren't very good at trying to make this appeal, considering that they blanket it in all sorts of awful, toxic, racist stuff that most sensible people, you know, would be horrified by and wouldn't even listen further to hear the promise of bringing jobs back home and the promise of keeping us safe. And the promise of, I think Ivanka Trump brought forward that they're going to have
paid family leave
and all that stuff. So you see that
did she pull that from Michelle Obama's speech? No, obviously not.
So you see this clear play of Donald Trump's Republican Party trying to rebrand itself a bit, but also failing because he just can't shake being a complete racist neo-fascist.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems like that is the case. I mean, you know, I mean, just as a side issue, too, I mean, it seems as if he has no substance to what he's saying, but his skill is that he's really a great entertainer. I mean, I just obviously, as people who know me know that I spent some time watching WWE. I mean, I just remember thinking there was like a shot of his whole family standing in the box, and it just... everyone was talking about the smoke-filled entrance, but I was like, man, this is just like the McMahons, how hard his family is going.
Sam Sachs has this theory.
I mean, that when Ted Cruz gave his speech and got booed, and all the boos started raining down on him, Trump appeared out of the rafters like he was Sting holding a baseball bat ready to wreak havoc on the NWO.
And the fans in the arena
responded the same way.
They were like, yes!
They all turned their back on Ted Cruz, stared up at Donald Trump as he emerged, and then walked back to the Vince McMahon box or the Donald Trump box where all his family's at. And Ted Cruz is just left on stage like, okay, I think I'll just wind up here and see myself out. Thanks, fellas. Where he was promptly kicked out of Sheldon Adelson's private room, or allowed in.
Yeah, wow, it's rough. It had to be rough for him. And I wonder, what did you guys make of Sanders' performance? I mean, I thought like, okay, I knew he was going to come in and endorse her. I knew that like for him was going to be the only way he could move forward. But it seemed almost like he wasn't just endorsing her, but he was a little bit obsequious. I mean, we don't know the whole story behind it, but at least what's being reported in the media is that he didn't really fight for Nina Turner when they pulled her from the agenda. And I don't know, something about it just rubbed me the wrong way, but I don't know how you guys felt about it.
I mean, I don't know. I do think it's kind of good that the Bernie I feel like punching myself for saying this. But I think at this point he kind of has to play ball with the DNC and the establishment Dems.
He had intended to play ball all along.
He did. Yeah. And you know, to his credit, I think he correctly pointed out that had he done the Ralph Nader route, for example, he would have been outside of debates, getting arrested or at least being threatened with arrest, rather than having the national stage over and over again, night in, night out for that long. Right. And you know, I don't know enough about the Nina Turner story specifically. I know that they wanted her to speak and the Clintons said no because she wouldn't endorse Hillary Clinton. I think that's pretty low. You know, you could have her come out.
Nina, say something.
Yeah,
right.
She's not that well known. Nina Turner is, you know,
and she was pushing unity on MSNBC. I mean, I remember people were telling her, are you going to endorse Jill Stein? Da, 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 da. And she was like, no, we got to stand the Democrats. We got to fight. Yeah. Da, da, da. So even if she didn't endorse Clinton, it seemed like very petty on the part of the Clintons because she would have come out there with a message. It wouldn't have been like, let's burn down the Wells Fargo.
No. But I also just very quickly, you know, who knows? I mean, it's the end of a long campaign and maybe Bernie's people were just like, we have nothing left. Like we've already fought. We've already had so many fights that we just can't. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I guess technically it's an endorsement of Clinton. But if you look at what Bernie said, it was basically, look, Trump is a disaster. We have to, for the sake of the country, elect Hillary Clinton. But just because we elect or make this opportunistic alliance here to elect Hillary Clinton doesn't mean we're going to be down with what Hillary Clinton says and does if she is elected. And in fact, we have to continue pushing her and continue fighting and keep the movement going. And I think that's what his ultimate message was. And it was a message that was reiterated by President Obama. And we've seen that even under Democratic administrations, you can still organize and push for a leftist change even more effectively than under Republican administrations.
Yeah, well, I'm actually a little bit, I'm oddly kind of like optimistic by the fact of like a Hillary Clinton presidency. And I wouldn't have said that in the absence of a Bernie Sanders movement.
Right.
But what it appears you have now is you're going to have, assuming she wins, you're going to have a very pliable Democratic candidate or Democratic president who is at least nominally accountable to the left and institutions, for example, like SEIU, AFT, you know, other labor organizations. And, you know, unlike when President Obama was elected in 2008, you also have a very engaged, very organized, or well, very much more organized left, a socialist left that wants to advance labor issues, which have obviously been neglected for so long. So, you know, with that dynamic, we might produce this bizarre scenario where at least on certain economic issues can get a lot done for the left over the next.
Well, I mean, and it also seems a little bit like there's some shades of the Tea Party here. I mean, when the Tea Party started and it was, you know, sort of well within the Republican Party, but we see what's played out with sort of the center not being able to hold inside the Republican establishment. Then you have the situation with Donald Trump where the whole party, this major political party, you know, it's been what, since like the 1890s, there's been any questioning of the two major political parties, almost fell apart.
So you're saying in 2024, we're going to see President Denis Kucinich? Because I'm looking forward to that.
Well, Denis Kucinich was a guest on the By Any Means Necessary show about a week ago.
I mean that absolutely earnestly. I think Denis was one of the best. You know, his politics were just so good. You know, even on Bernie and Elizabeth Warren, you can point out a few things that they weren't good on, especially foreign policy. Congressman Kucinich gets it.
I'm glad you brought up the Tea Party because, look, the Tea Party was funded. It was an AstroTurf movement funded by a lot of rich people. It wasn't as spontaneous as the Bernie Sanders movement, for example, or the Occupy movement that we've seen. And I think there are a lot of parallels between the Occupy movement and the Bernie Sanders movement. But the way the Republican Party reacted to the Tea Party movement is instructive because the Republican Party didn't say, oh, these guys are lunatic, fringe people. Let's push them aside. Let's stay true to our establishment politicians and keep running them. The Republican Party, for the most part, embraced the Tea Party movement, much to the detriment of some of their establishment figures, but it ended up paying dividends in giving them the House, giving them the Senate.
Right.
And who knows, potentially giving them the presidency this year. I think Donald Trump is a bit of an outcrop from the Tea Party movement as well. Whereas on the Democrat side, you have the Occupy movement that rose up, and then you now have the Bernie Sanders movement that's grown sort of out of it. And the party doesn't want to embrace that, to turn that into energy that could be used in midterm elections or general elections down the road. Instead, they're turning it away. And that is a huge mistake that they're making, and it might cost them this election.
And I just wanted to make a point on that, sort of taking the conversation back to when, Sam, you were talking about how at least the Republicans are trying to win over, you know, working voters, even if their ideas are all terrible and they're all con men. Which is, I was so shocked, and I've brought this up before in your presence, but anyway, I was so shocked that...
unanimous dissent on Radio Sputnik. You can listen to all sorts of things from the Sam.
Right. But I was really shocked...
I'm bored already.
I was really shocked that Mike Pence, in his intro to the country, first introduced himself as, quote, a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican in that order. Mm. And yet he still found the time to make what seemed like an earnest appeal to Bernie Sanders supporters. Like, oh, yeah, Bernie Sanders, you know how bad the Clintons are. I don't recognize this America in which a Republican brings up a socialist to score points, who brings him up in a positive light.
Yeah.
To
I mean,
score
it's
points.
In his YouTube. If you look at YouTube videos about anything Sanders related now, there's these Trump ads that are coming up in the ads ahead of time.
It's
and it's
insane.
All about Bernie Sanders never had a chance.
It's crazy. And everyone was saying that, you know, if he had been the nominee, then his numbers would have started to go down because then the Republicans would have brought out the red baiting. But Yeah, it doesn't really look like anyone on the right is interested in red baiting right now. It's all coming from the liberals. Right.
It'll be interesting to see if we are really in the midst of some sort of political realignment right now in America. I mean, I could see Trump getting beaten and then the Republican Party just reverting back to the way it was, being like, okay, we've, you know, washed ourselves clean of this. And then the Democratic Party just taking where it's been the whole time as well. But look, if Trump wins, we could be seeing a major political realignment in this country in which the Democratic Party becomes even more hawkish mm-hmm. than it already is, bringing into the fold the neoconservative movement and more moderate Republicans. And in which case you'd have a right party, a conservative party in the Democratic Party, and a radical right-wing nationalistic policy party right. With the Republican Party under Trump. And maybe out of that, we could get a split in the Democrats and have another left-wing party rise up out of that. But I think that the political consensus, at least right now, temporarily has been broken. And where the parties traditionally are on issues is kind of up in the air until we see what happens out of this election.
Right. And I mean, and then there's so much to be, I mean, in such a, when everything is to play for, it seems like also the agency of individuals is like, which we can't predict, is going to be such a determining factor.
Yeah. We just talked about it on our show of how tough of a decision this is for people. You have the two most unpopular people to ever run for president, right. Hillary Clinton and right. Donald Trump. You've got Hillary Clinton, one of the most known political quantities out there. We know where she's voted on issues. We know where she stands. We know what she believes in. And we have Donald Trump, who is a complete unknown when it comes to policy, but has spewed very troubling rhetoric that suggests that he could be a disastrous leader. I don't know how you make a choice with a known quantity who's bad or an unknown quantity that could be worse.
No, I hear you. I mean, it was shocking to me to see the New York Times news analysis of Hillary Clinton's convention speech was like, she doesn't ask voters to trust her. And I was just like, wow. Like, I mean, that's a big statement about, you know, what kind of election we're going into.
Whereas Trump was mad that she didn't bring up her emails in the speech. Which, yeah, you're right, Trump. She didn't mention the 30,000 missing emails or what happened in Benghazi during her speech. I wonder why.
She should have brought up those Benghazi guys to say they were going to drop someone like a sack of potatoes.
She should have held up a piece of paper proving she killed Vince Foster.
You know, Travelgate will be back. There's no doubt about that. I mean, there's so many gates, too. I mean, I just, in a way, am semi looking forward to just reliving the gate of everything. But we're going to have to leave it there for now. But big thanks to Sam Knight and Sam Sachs. You can listen to, and for all of my true supporters, you will listen to Unanimous wow. Dissent on Radio Sputnik. It's also available on iTunes. And you can also check out more from both these guys at their website, districtsentinel.com. Thank you guys so much. And you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. We're going to take a break. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. We'll be back.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing talking about the potential for nuclear catastrophe, some of the intersections between anti-nuclear work and black liberation, and what other threats could be facing us at home and abroad. And we are very, very excited to be joined in studio by Lily Daigle, the network campaigner for Global Zero, and Dr., the good Dr., Vincent Intondi, professor at Montgomery College, and also the author of African Americans Against the Bomb. Thank you guys so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Of course. So, you know, recently I was reading the New York Review of Books. There is a review there of Clinton's Defense Secretary Bill Perry, and it's all about nuclear weapons, nuclear war. It's an issue he's worked on, I guess, for some time. And he said, and I quote, "Today, the danger of some sort of a nuclear catastrophe is greater than it was during the Cold War, and most people are blissfully unaware of this danger." Lily, I'll start with you. Do you agree with that statement?
Yes, I do, unfortunately.
And why?
You know, I think after the end of the Cold War, the issue of nuclear weapons and nuclear proliferation has fallen off the map for the vast majority of the American public. And I think today, the prevalence of non-state actors who are working tirelessly day and night to acquire nuclear material to create a bootleg nuclear weapon is higher than it was really ever in history.
Mm-hmm. Vin, what do you think?
Agreed. I think one of the reasons why we don't see as much attention is because of all of the other issues going on today, especially with our youth. They're so busy trying to put food on the table, pay student loans, and not get killed by the police, just trying to survive, that this is such an abstract issue for many of them where they can't even wrap their heads around this.
Yeah, no, I think that that's certainly true. And I think to a certain degree, although we're seeing a rising climate justice movement, it's like when you're dealing with planetary catastrophe, it does have a certain sort of abstract reality to it. I mean, I wonder too, Vin, the only mention in both the RNC and the DNC of anything related to nuclear weapons, which, by the way, could destroy the whole planet. You got Bill Clinton's former defense secretary saying the danger is greater than ever before. The only mention was like one side mention of like, hey, we don't want Donald Trump with his finger on the button. But that, I mean, that's all that gets that really gets in there. I don't know how you felt about that.
Yeah, it's just so startling because for me, if you take you peel everything away, something I've consistently argued is when you go in the voting booth, what is the most important issue? And I think at least one of them should be if we ever are faced with an October 1962 again, who do we want sitting in that chair? Who do we want? Obviously, nobody should have that ability, right? But if we are going to be faced with it, who should be sitting in that chair? And the fact that it's never raised, not an issue to vote around, it's not an issue that's going to get votes is just ridiculous.
Yeah, no, and just side note here, 13 Days is a good movie. So all the haters, just get off it. Good movie. But Lily, I mean, you work on this issue day in, day out. It's not as if there's no support for doing something about nuclear weapons. So why doesn't it break through in things like, you know, big political conventions?
I don't know, Eugene, and if you figure it out, let me know. But I think, you know, I think a big thing is it's not a sexy issue. I was actually hanging out. I just got back from the DNC last night.
That's right. You did a banner drop there, I believe.
I did. Yeah.
Good-looking banner.
Pretty frustrated that political candidates aren't talking about the issue of nuclear weapons. So what else are you going to do but drop a banner?
Right.
But I was hanging out with some friends at work on climate justice, and they were asking me why I made the switch to nuclear weapons. Mm. It took about 5 minutes for them to get very scared and a little bit upset. I mean, we're spending $2.2 million an hour on our nuclear arsenal, yet no one is talking about it.
Right. Well, how? $2.2 million? I'm not even going to do any math here. I don't do any math. But and we're getting ready to spend. I mean, that's like what we spend right now. But isn't there there's like $1 trillion, I think, coming down the pike?
Yes, there is. Yep. $1 trillion nuclear overhaul, which will be happening over the next 30 years, is in the process of being voted on by our members of Congress right now.
Wow. Do you think it will pass?
I pray to God that some parts of it will not pass, specifically the LRSO or the new nuclear cruise missile. Many groups are working to kind of nix off that, but it does look like, since there is not that much support from the American public on kind of the nuclear issue, it does look like a big part of it will pass.
Well, Vin, let me also ask you this. I mean, and that was, I thought, another subtext of both conventions. And I mean, you could talk about this military industrial complex writ large, is that, you know, people are saying, and obviously the Republicans have a bunch of crazy answers, but either way, everyone's saying, you know, there's problems in the cities. We got to rebuild the cities. We got to give people opportunity. But I mean, then no one is talking about how they're just going to pour $1 trillion down the drain on these projects that obviously it's going to be more than $1 trillion. I mean, you look at everything. They just had that new aircraft carrier, $12.9 billion, and it doesn't even work. So now they got to spend more money. So, I mean, this seems like a complete disconnect between the money that's being spent on weapons like these that I think arguably are totally unnecessary and what people are saying we need to do here at home.
Yeah, and that's something that we need to do a better job of educating on, right? So when the anti-nuclear movement, the peace movement, was in some ways at its most successful state in the 1980s, they were successfully doing this. They had a campaign of bombs over babies. They were showing where this money could be better spent in different cities. So if we were able to say this $1 trillion number has become very abstract, it's a trillion. We hear this $1 trillion number, which is true. But again, how many know exactly where it's going to and to what? And so if we were able to say, have mayors of different cities that were economically depressed and say, look, what would $1 million do here? What would $2 million do there? How would we shift this money from a nuclear weapon to a school? They would have a buy-in. They would know that they're invested in this now, that there's something to actually fight for, and they would make that correlation. I mean, so much of these conventions have been about the economy and about a jobs program and so on and so forth. Well, this is directly connected. The flip side of that coin is if you go to places, especially like a place like Syracuse, New York, where the main employer is Lockheed Martin, which is making certain nuclear weapons, then you're fighting a jobs program like you would be with coal in West Virginia, right? And so you have to battle that as well. And so that's, in some places, the conundrum that you get into.
No, for sure. And I know, obviously, the Trident renewal there in the UK, that was the big issue, right? All the unions unite and all these other left-wing unions were like, well, what are you going to do with these workers? Narrow view from my opinion, but I guess, hey, that one is in the books, unfortunately. And I wonder, too, Vin, I mean, you wrote the book African Americans Against the Bomb. If also sort of just grounding some of the historical context about what the anti-nuclear movement really was can also have an effect, because I think the way it's presented is like, oh, we're just a bunch of middle class white people or whatever. But as you point out in your book, I mean, a number of the people who are being hugely celebrated right now by Black Lives Matter, this is a big issue for them.
Yeah. So the whole key of that book in these leaders and even just ordinary folks in the Black community consistently looked at this issue in a different lens. They looked at it through the lens of race. So they were connecting and saying, the victims of the first nuclear attack were non-white. Those who are being threatened with nuclear war are non-white. They looked at the issue of colonialism. Where was France testing their first nuclear weapon? In Africa. Where were we getting the uranium to make nuclear weapons? The Belgian-controlled Congo. And it was African Americans who were consistently making this argument. And they were doing it while they were fighting internal racism within a peace movement that was dominated by mostly white middle class pacifists who in many cases didn't want these issues connected and wanted it to be a single issue. And it was the Black community that was saying, no, this is absolutely connected. And so I think that's something we need to get back to. But that ties to a larger issue of Pan-Africanism and how the African and African-American community are in some ways disconnected in ways that they weren't before.
Mm-hmm. No, well, there's certainly a lot of truth to that. And I wonder, Lily, I mean, how does this impact of broadening the movement, how do you look at it from the point of view of the work either you're doing now or at least that you want to try to do projecting forward?
I think that making our movement more diverse and intersectional is critical for us to win. You know, this issue is so often siloed, mostly by ourselves, as being nuclear weapons and that's it. But there is so much more at stake. It's economic justice, it's social justice issue. I mean, the intersectionality between this and the climate movement even it's astounding. And I think in order for us to win, we're going to have to really invest some time and energy and building those relationships and connecting the dots between our different struggles.
I remember when the biggest climate issue was like nuclear waste. That was the first one I ever heard. Well, that and Save the Whales. You know, they used to have these shirts in Miami called Save the Bales in the 80s from all the cocaine that would wash up from these ships that were breaking. Anyway, that's a historical side point. But, you know, one other thing I wonder, and we talk a lot on this show about violence in a lot of contexts, police violence, intercommunal violence. And one of the things I always think about is just how violent our culture is. I mean, I don't know how to like measure this, but obviously, you know, what was the ad that really won Lyndon Johnson the election in 64? The Daisy ad, the nuclear war, you know, people coming off of World War II. But now it's just like every person, you got the Call of Duty and every TV show is just like people going and killing people and whatever. I mean, politicians pushing people in front of trains, shout out House of Cards, whatever it may be. It's just so violent. And I wonder if people are just desensitized now. And when you say like, yeah, we could destroy the whole world, it's like, ah, I mean, whatever, you know, I was just playing a video game and I dropped a nuke the other day. Like, I mean, I don't know. It just seems like maybe our culture is part of a stumbling block, too. Lily, I'll start with you on what you think there.
No, I think in big part that's true. And I think another big part besides kind of this barrage of violence that we experience every day in media and culture and on the streets is a big part of it. I think another big part of it is that people just don't understand the magnitude of what these weapons can do. One nuclear weapon can kill people if dropped in D.C. as far away as New York City.
Ooh. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's definitely serious. Vin, same point.
Yeah. I think there is a point to be made on the culture of violence. Now, I preface that with saying I remember growing up where I played video games and I didn't then go out and think these things. I mean, part of it's how you're raised and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But that said, the video games are certainly different today. And you know, just in an overall culture of violence, when my students watch Born on the 4th of July and learn about Ron Kovic's story, right, when they read Johnny Got His Gun, it's at those moments when I say to them, where in Call of Duty is the part where you change the colostomy bag? Where is it that you have to put your catheter in, right? This is what war is that you have no idea about because you're playing these video games. In terms of nuclear weapons specifically, I think part of it is, even in a very micro sense, the language we use. When we say nuke instead of nuclear weapon, even that is desensitizing how we look at this. How much, when we see a hurricane or a storm, even 9/11, do we hear the phrase, look like a nuclear weapon went off? No, it didn't, because there's such a lack of learning that history. When a nuclear weapon went off, there's nothing like it. Mm. And so that's where learning that history comes in, learning what it really does. And, you know, this is just, and it's a continuation when you have somebody like Tim Kaine, who's running for vice president, when he is saying that his favorite president is Harry Truman. You know, that raises serious issues when we're the only president to use a nuclear weapon. I mean, and that's who you're promoting as being the best president?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's unbelievable. And I believe it was Memorial Day. You can hear on the Loud and Clear show on Radio Sputnik, if you go back and look, Peter Kuznick, the academic from American University, just breaking down how, you know, they dropped this bomb. I mean, not for no reason, but for no good reason and everything behind it. So I won't get into it. But I mean, Truman, unbelievable. Also one of the most racist presidents ever, 100% against civil rights. It just... crazy. Although I think he's the only president in the 20th century to not go to college. So it does prove at least that you don't need an advanced degree to kill millions of people. But that being said, I just, I'm glad you brought up the point about the history, because, you know, a few days after this show is going to air, we're going to be facing the 71st anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I always think about it, you know, I've told this story before in the show. You know, my father was in Hiroshima in 52, I believe, and there was still, this is 52 now, so what is it, 7 years later? And not only were many of the buildings not rebuilt, but he was telling me you could still go by the walls of houses that had been destroyed. The shadows of people who had been killed were burned into the wall because they were just annihilated so quickly. So, I mean, I don't want to freak people out too much, but I do think that we should say, I mean, what is it that these weapons can do? How much power is it?
Yeah, I mean, and that's why coming up on the 71st anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you know, we're talking about at Global Zero, who will keep us safe? How can you keep us safe as long as there are 15,000 of these weapons in the world today, most of which are dozens of times more powerful than the ones that we dropped on Hiroshima and mm-hmm. Nagasaki?
And you're bringing a survivor here to D.C. to help tell some of the story of what that's like, correct?
Yes. So here in D.C., Global Zero is teaming up with a number of national and kind of local groups. And one of them is the Hiroshima Nagasaki Peace Committee, who every year brings a habaksha, which is the Japanese word for atomic survivor or a survivor of an atomic bomb. And he'll be coming to speak at our event called Bike Around the Bomb here on Saturday, August 6th at 10 a.m. in front of the White House, speaking about his experiences. And he'll also be joining us on the bike ride. He's been practicing every day for 3 months to join us.
Wow. And this gentleman is like 80-some.
I think he's 79.
79. Just righted. Is doing better than I on the bike situation. But Vin, I know you've been to Japan. You've been there. You've participated in some of the peace activities that happened there. I mean, talk a little bit about what the historical memory is like in Japan as well.
Yeah, it's weird because right now I'm in Japan mode. Usually this time I'd be leaving, I think, tomorrow with Peter Kuznick as we go every single year. This year I took a year off to research the second book and so on and so forth. But and I'll be joining Lily to bike around the bomb. And in Japan right now, it's a mix. You have an extreme right wing Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who wants to change the peace constitution, remilitarize the country, expand the military base in Okinawa, gives tepid apologies for World War II atrocities. So it's a really bad situation. And so what you have is my Japanese students there, in many ways, their history is being whitewashed. They don't even know that true history. And then I also have, we usually have a contingent from China, and their history is whitewashed. And then we have our American students. So education is not where it obviously should be on this issue, but to see the bonding experience go on of all these students throughout the 2 weeks we're there, hearing from different habaksha and going to museums and ceremonies and so on and so forth is extraordinary. That is the most important part. I mean, say what you will about Obama's visit, but they have said that I believe it's 75%. That's the increase of people visiting the museum since he's been there. So just that alone, getting people to go in there and see what it's like is important.
And Lillian, the work that you do, I mean, what's the biggest misconception that you come up with when you're talking to people? I think we're talking a lot about people not being educated. I mean, what's that first thing that you hear a lot?
I think the first two things that I hear is that, one, most people don't know how many nuclear weapons there are in the world or that the United States have.
And how many do people usually think there are in the whole world?
Literally anywhere between 5 and 500,000.
Wow, five.
It really depends. Ooh. Yeah. Wow, okay. One day we'll get to five, and then we'll get to zero, and it will be a powerful moment.
Excellent pivot from global zero, please. But continue, the second one.
People just don't understand how much money these weapons cost. And once, you know, when you're in a classroom filled with college students and tell them that we're about to spend $1 trillion overhauling these weapons that don't make us safer and really just guarantee our eventual annihilation, people get upset.
I mean, it's almost like gallows humor that we're laughing here. I mean, I don't know, just like annihilation of the human race. I mean, it just seems like no one would want to do that, Vin.
Well, when I teach this every semester in one of my U.S. history courses, in the beginning, before we even start the discussion, my students overwhelmingly will say the same thing again, that it was used because it ended the war quicker, that it saved millions of American lives had there been a ground invasion. So they are still under the impression that it was militarily necessary to end the war and that Japanese was going to fight to the end. So again, it's back to this history where the narrative, they have this history that's passed down through bad biography and popular history and Spielberg films. And this kind of U.S. exceptionalism narrative that just keeps getting passed down. So it's trying to cut through all of that is part of the struggle as an educator.
Yeah, well, we're going to have to leave it there from now. We're out of time for today's show, but you were listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C., and a special thanks to our last two guests, Lily Daigle, the network campaigner for Global Zero, and Dr. Vincent Intondi, professor at Montgomery College and author of a great book, African Americans Against the Bomb, and thanks to all our other guests today. You can hear us here and every day on RadioSputnik.com or on iTunes. Send your comments and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at BAM Necessary. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By any means necessary.